April 15th to 18th, there is a weekend, which is sponsored by Center for Creative Inquiry, and that's also at Rottnalee. And in that one, I'm going to be co-teaching with a couple of people, one of whom is a Zen teacher. He holds a Zen lineage. And we're going to be looking at inquiry in TSK and in Zen, with a little bit of a introduction, at least, to Zen koans. I think it's a non-traditional introduction, but that should be interesting. And let's see, June 20th through 27th, I think it is. I may have the dates wrong by a day or so. I'm doing a TSK program in Germany in a little town called Pluckhorst. And those of you in Europe know all about that, I'm sure, but I just wanted to remind you, and you can find out more. That's being offered. You can find out more by contacting either the center in Köln in Germany or the center in Amsterdam. They're kind of co-sponsoring that along with the Center for Creative Inquiry. And then finally, there's a program in August, and I don't have the dates for that in front of me. That's a long ways away. But you can find out, I'm sure, by looking at our website. That, again, is at Rottnalee, and that's a week-long retreat. And that one is the one that is really meant to be tied into this program in the sense that we will go back over the material and we will focus much more. And the thing about retreats is that you can focus a lot more on practice, a kind of intensive practice. And, you know, what we've been doing in the program is making sure we're kind of working with the vision, working with the presentation in Love of Knowledge as a practice in itself, and then supplementing that with practices, mostly practices that you can do during the day, during your working, during your lives. And you can go into them more intensively if you have the chance. But on retreat, we really go more in the direction of exploring this experientially, a lot of practice, certainly some discussion too. If you know me, you know that there will always be some discussion, but the discussion has to be balanced, will be balanced by a focus on practice. So that's all of my announcements of upcoming programs. And again, the reminder that the reading is chapters for next week, chapters 21 and 22. So now, let's start in the chapter 19. Now, chapter 19, this whole section, the middle of Love of Knowledge, is really, I think, quite beautiful in the way that Rinpoche lays bare, makes clear some of the underlying assumptions that govern our way of being in the world, and really suggests ways that we can challenge those. So he's asking the question, or we're exploring the question as we go ahead with the reading. On one level, kind of on the philosophical level, we're asking the question, what is real? You know, what can we rely on in our experience? If we want to have a life that is fulfilling and satisfying, we can't be living it on the basis of confusion and a mistaken understanding of what's real. So that question of what is real is important for us on every level, philosophically, but also kind of existentially, you could say. But there's another way to think about that, and we're going more in that direction now. And that is not only asking what is real, but asking what is satisfying. You know, what will make our lives richer and more fulfilling? And it's not a different question. It's the same question, but it's coming at it in terms of our motivations. And the reason that becomes more relevant now, or becomes an approach now, is because we are dealing with this whole question of intentional knowledge. And, you know, in the West, we're very used to making a fundamental distinction, which is often referred to as the distinction between the is and the ought. In other words, we say such and such is real, that's what is so, and then the ought is the question, what should we be doing? How should we be living our lives? And science is very much devoted to the question of the is, and then they tend to say, well, we don't deal with the question of what you ought to do. We don't deal with ethical questions or moral questions. So because that's the way we've structured knowledge in the West, we make that distinction and we insist on it pretty strongly. The approach in TSK doesn't make that distinction necessarily at all, and in fact, existentially, it doesn't make much sense. You know, if we're always wanting to know what we should be doing, we're always wanting to know how we should act, but the foundation for our action is our understanding of what's real. And so, in a way, that's what we've been exploring for weeks and weeks now. On the one hand, the descriptive knowledge that tells us what's real, what's so, the way things are. And on the other hand, now we're really looking at intentional knowledge, which is how we structure and shape our reality. I think that makes this part of the book really very engaging. You know, because that's what we care about, you know. We care about our own lives, our own decisions, our own choices. And of course we care about enjoying our lives and the world of feelings and desires and so on, which is exactly what Rinpoche talks about here. He says, we don't really have any good way of getting clear on the nature of reality, and so one response to that is to focus on our own wants and needs. And it's not as though you're making a distinction between those two, but it's a difference in orientation, a difference in approach, and that's what we're talking about when we talk about intentional knowledge. You know, the intentional knowledge has to do with what the self wants, what its projects are, what its goals are. What do we do to live lives that feel more fulfilled? And what Rinpoche points out here is that when we look at intentional knowledge, there are consequences in terms of the same focus that we've had all along, which is a focus on the past, the present, and the future. That is, there are consequences in terms of our understanding of time. So it's not as though we're now sort of going back into an interesting philosophical question and leaving aside the concerns of the self. The point here is that the nature of the self is to be completely a temporal creature. And the nature, you know, the way in which the self is temporal, I mean, I think it's very obvious if you look at it in terms of your experience. In order to have a self, you have to have a past and you have to have a future, and Rinpoche talks about that. You have to have a kind of an identity, because the self is ultimately the identity that we proclaim for ourselves, the very special identity that the self has as compared to the identity that animals and trees and so on have. So you have to have a past, but you also have to have a future. And the focus now is going toward that future, because that's how the self makes sense out of its own circumstances, in terms of its goals, in terms of its desires. I think I'm saying things that are really pretty clearly presented in the reading, but I wanted to make sure that people understood where we were. I will kind of try to situate us in this ongoing inquiry. Are there any questions at that point? Does that seem pretty clear? Mm-hmm. Seems pretty clear. Okay.
Can I ask something?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yes.
Short form is intentional knowing. Intending is not experiencing.
Intending is not experiencing.
Yeah.
Is that your question?
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. Intending is not experiencing, except that we anticipate certain things. You know, if we are looking forward to this phone call, let's say, that's a form of intentional knowledge. And there is the specific feeling of anticipation or excitement or in a different situation, maybe agitation. So that is an aspect of experience. But basically, no, the intending is not the experiencing. And it's actually an important point because it seems as though experiencing always happens in the present, whereas intending is always directed toward the future.
Yeah.
And that actually leads me exactly to what I wanted to say or to point out in the readings. We're at the point now where we can kind of look at the self as a structure that exists in time. That is to say, I pull my identity from the past, I pull my intentions, my sense of what matters to me, my values, the sense of meaning, I pull all of that out of the future, and then it seems as though I have a kind of immediate experience in the present. But because I'm spread out like that, and in dynamics of time and space, that's how Rinpoche describes it, and I think it's very helpful. He says the self is spread out across time because of that link to the past and the future. And because of that, I'm cut off from my own experience. And that's the point that Rinpoche makes very powerfully. I've always thought this was a wonderful statement at the top of page 156. And I'm just going to read it. He says, "Tightly bound by yesterday, swept along into tomorrow, the self is cut off from its world, stranded and isolated. Its ways of knowing foster not knowing. Its ways of fulfillment result in frustration. The self lives in the present like a traveler in an inhospitable foreign land, ill at ease, unsure of how to act, never really at home with its experience." I think that's a really powerful statement. And there's another passage, I think it's in this book, but it's in one of the books anyway, where Rinpoche uses that same image of the self as a traveler in a foreign land, and he adds something else, which I think is also very powerful and suggestive. He says, a traveler in a foreign land who's always afraid that his visa is going to be revoked. Right? Because we always have this feeling that we're here and things are not quite in order. Maybe we didn't fill out the form properly, and somebody may come knocking on the door and say, "We have a few questions for you, Mr. Self."
Oh my God, I feel like that all the time.
So that is our situation, and we've gone through this quite careful analysis of the relationship that we have to the past and the present and the future, and in a sense, this is the summary statement that we've arrived at. We don't really have knowledge we can rely on. We aren't in contact with our own world. We're dependent on this structure of linear time, of past, present, future. And Rinpoche takes us to the next step of that, which I think is really also very interesting. He says, well, what if we just say, I'm going to give up on trying to understand my world. Maybe I'm even going to give up on trying to develop projects and goals that are meaningful. He doesn't say that exactly, but that seems to me what's being said here. And I am just going to try to have a good time. He didn't quite say that either, but he says we can rely on our feelings, right? That's what he, in this chapter, when we come to the section called the life of feelings. That's what he's saying. He's saying, you know, it doesn't make sense, it doesn't seem to work to try to make sense of my life or to set goals that I could really accomplish, but at least I know that sometimes I have feelings that are positive, and when I do, that feels very good. And if only I could be like that all the time, then, you know, at least life wouldn't be so bad. So we just give up on anything more meaningful in our lives and just try to have a good time. Just try to feel. Image that always comes to my mind there is one that I'm sure many of you have read about in psychology experiments. Though this was maybe 20, 30 years ago already, an experiment where they would wire electrodes into a mouse's brain, and when the mouse pushed the lever, it would stimulate a certain part of its brain, which, as I remember, I may be wrong, excuse me, produced dopamine, and dopamine makes you feel good. I think it was dopamine, I'm not positive. And that mouse would keep pushing that lever because it was just enjoying the feeling. And it would push that lever and do nothing else until it died. It wouldn't eat. It wouldn't drink. It certainly wouldn't go out and try to build the wonderful mouse kingdom or anything like that. It just pushed that lever until it died. And there is a certain sense in which, you know, that's a kind of, in theory, that's an option that we could choose. It sounds like a pretty terrible option to most people, but there is a legitimate school of philosophy in the West called utilitarianism that says the goal of human life is for people to be happy. And so I'm always going to choose what makes people happy, and that's how I'm going to live my life. So that's actually an intentional stance. The self says, you know, the philosopher says, that's the goal that I choose. But the practice is to make people happy. So in theory, if you could wire everybody in the world up to one of these levers, and they just spent the rest of their lives until they died pushing the lever, you would have satisfied that goal. It's kind of a terrible image, and you can see it in literature. But in any event, Rinpoche says, you know, you don't really have to worry about that because it doesn't work. And I don't know what he would say about that example of the mouse, you know, where you wire things up so that the mouse gets pleasure, immediate gratification, all the time, every moment, again and again. Tina asks if that's the singing mouse, which I think I must have referred to somewhere. It's not. That's a different mouse. Okay.
Josephine the Mouse Singer.
Yeah, Josephine the Mouse Singer. This is just some nameless mouse. Never got a chance to do anything because it was too busy pushing the lever, so how could it have a name? Okay, and by the way, as long as I'm answering questions that are being typed in, Lois was asking if this class meets in the summer, and the answer is no. If you want to push the lever that gives you the pleasure of TSK in the summer, you have to come to a retreat or a program of some kind. Okay, so why doesn't it work, leaving aside this extreme case of the mouse? And the answer basically is that you are still tied to the same structure. Even if you're trying to satisfy your desires and your wants, and that's all you care about, you still have the same structure of reaching out into the future to get something. You know, first comes the moment of wanting, and then, if you're lucky, comes the moment of gratification. So the thing for the mouse, I guess, is that those two moments are just right next to each other. The mouse knows exactly how to gratify its desire. But if you don't take that extreme case, not only do we not know how to gratify our desires, that is, we'd like for things to be a certain way, but we don't know how to accomplish that goal, but the very structure of linear time, reaching out into the future, means that we cannot satisfy our desire. Because the desire, and I'm sure it goes into this, the desire is something that exists in the future. That is, the thing that we desire exists in the future. So then when we get it in the present, you know, it isn't the same thing anymore. So the very structure fails. Now, I want to ask here, I suggested that you could work with that exercise, the object of desire, which is the exercise in this chapter, actually. Did anybody work with that, try that? Anybody have anything they'd like to say about it?
I guess I do.
Okay.
I looked at it, and I thought, geez, things I really desire. I don't want to be like going to lust, say, be like going to Hooters in the middle of your work day, and it would just wreck your state of mind. And neither did I want to go into something that I really am interested in doing, and I would like to have an outcome. Like, say I'm writing something now, I don't want to start fantasizing about how it could be received, because that would divert me from the energy, and like this, the wisdom of love of knowledge is sort of showing me that I should just keep going,
mm-hmm.
and let the energies unfold and not start hypothesizing what I would like to happen with it. So I picked something fairly benign. I picked a novel that's been in the garage for 10 years, and maybe I would like that to be James Cameron to pick it up and start doing special effects or something. And something I really wouldn't believe likely, but I could like it if it happened.
Right.
But I basically, like, what you've just been describing about this life of desires, I don't want to get into that. I'm afraid of it.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I, you know, it may be that if you really go through that exercise in the sense of seeing what would it actually be like, kind of play it out to have a desire gratified, that may be a very good way of getting some insight into what Rinpoche is saying here when he says that the very structure of desire means that by its nature it's unfulfilled, or you will remain unfulfilled. Whether you get it or not, you will remain unfulfilled.
But I gave 10 years of that particular altar of daydreaming, and I don't want to go back to it, kind of.
I think that's that notion of worshiping at the altar of a particular desire is a very good one. I think that issue of daydreaming is also a really good example because, well, let me just say that I'm very familiar with it. You know, when you're working on something, writing something or whatever it is, crafting something, engaged in some project in your job, whatever it is, there's always that option of kind of sliding into a little fantasy about how much everybody's going to love it or how much praise you're going to get or what a significant impact it's going to have or any of a number of different things. And maybe that's the more true for writers and artists and people who are trying to bring something new into the world, because then you imagine the impact that that new thing is going to have. But, you know, it's actually not so different from people who fantasize about having a family or what their children are going to be like when they grow up, whatever it is. Lois says here there's the satisfaction and seduction of doing the project itself. I'm not sure if that relates to the future or not, but maybe you can say a little more. Tina says most writers are used to rejection, and as she said that, somebody hung up. So I felt rejected. there's another very powerful image in this chapter that I imagine people noticed, and that is the one that when you try to rely on your own feelings, it's like a dog sucking on a bone, an old toothless dog. And the dog just tastes its own blood because the bone is cutting into its gums and says, oh, what a juicy bone this is. That's a very powerful image, too, but I think we've already kind of discussed how that works. And the conclusion that you're left with here in that paragraph that I read before states it very strongly is it's a sad, I mean, it's a very sad conclusion in the sense that if that's all you have, you know, if the best you can hope for is that you will have lots and lots of positive feelings, but in fact the structure of the self and its dependence on time guarantees that that wish, that hope, isn't going to work, that's a very sad circumstance. And, there's a Henry David Thoreau, who actually connects this to time, wrote, this is 150 years ago, he wrote, the mass of human beings, actually he said the mass of men, lead lives of quiet desperation. And the conclusion in this chapter, or at least this part of the chapter, is basically that. And what I think saves it from being a, just totally depressing to read is that there's such a clarity to the analysis that as you're reading, and even if you've read this chapter 20 times, the clarity of the analysis is always there. As you're reading, there's a kind of an appreciation for being able to see into these structures so clearly. And that appreciation is, in some way, steps outside the pattern. I don't want to insist on that too much, but I'm just giving you my own reaction, that there's something so beautiful in this analysis. And art is like that, you could say. It's a little bit like seeing a very sad movie, if it's a very well-done movie. I can't think of an example right now, but I'm sure you can come up with one. A movie that leaves you feeling very pessimistic or kind of hopeless about the human situation, and yet at the same time, the very truth and strength of the beauty of the movie. We've got a couple of suggestions coming up in the chat room, so I encourage people to look at those. I'm not going to go into it. Although I will say that I've always thought TSK demands a film series. One of these days we're going to, maybe one day I'll do an online program where everybody looks at the same film, rents the same film, and then there's a discussion about it online. Maybe we could even show it online at this, I don't know. Anyway, because I think movies are very powerful. So that's a different question. So movies that are very, speak right to the truth of that aspect of the human situation, and yet the clarity and the beauty of the presentation somehow transcend that message and show you that's only one side of it. So that's where this chapter, this aspect of the chapter leaves me. Now I want to suggest that we do a practice related to that. It's a practice a little bit like what we did last week. Well, it is like what we did. Last week I suggested, what if you tried just going into experience I'm going to use someone else's formulation, someone who responded to the exercise later, because I can't remember what I said. What if you went into an experience and you stripped away the sense that that experience belonged to a self? Now, in order to do that, you would also have to strip away the sense of experience unfolding in linear time, from past to present to future, because the self and linear time are completely connected to one another on that level. But you don't have to really worry about that as a separate aspect. I'm just pointing it out because that's so central to the theme here. But the practice that we did last week was, and we just did it for a couple of minutes, so we didn't go very far with it. The practice was to try stripping away the self as the owner of the experience that you were having. And I want to suggest that we do that again. We don't have a lot of time this time either. We'll just try it for a couple of minutes and then see if there's some discussion. The only difference this time is focus on the breath. And, you know, most of you have some experience with meditation and probably have experience with meditation practice that focuses on the breath. Lois, I tend to always repeat the instructions, so I'm going to repeat the instructions. So the practice is to focus on breathing and see if you can contact breathing without that being something that the self is doing. That's what I mean by stripping away the self. And the reason that breathing is such a good practice to do that with is that you can control your breath. You, the self, can control the breath, but it also just goes on by itself. You don't have to control it. You don't have to think about it at all. So it's an easy place to see those two different alternatives. So let's do that for a couple of minutes and then see, in the light of what we've been saying, in the light of the possibility that we don't have to experience through the self, or that even in the bleakest moments of our experience as selves, there is the possibility for a clarity or knowing that does not belong to the self. That's what we're trying to explore right now. Let's do the practice for a couple of minutes and see what comes out of it, okay?
Yes. Can you hear?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It seems to me very difficult because I start to think about my exercise and I think about the praxis, and to see and to feel my breathing, the more I was away from this experience without, through the self. Oh, it's difficult to, I cannot say, it seems to me nearly impossible to breathe without. So I must stop. It is very confused. But my experience was confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I was close to my breathing, I was aware of my being aware. And this is work for myself.
Right.
Perhaps I must do some exercise
for
20 minutes. It would be better work. So, yes?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends, you know. Sometimes when you do this practice, even in the first moment, and sometimes I think it even helps to say, well, we're just going to do it for a very short time,
yes.
You can kind of cut through. But sometimes you can get lost in this circle that you've been describing. You start to do the practice, and you focus on the breath, and then you're aware of how you're focusing on the breath, and so on. But if you take a look at the different comments that people have been leaving in the chat session, which is nice, I'm coming to appreciate this chat typing thing more and more than I did originally. You know, a number of people here comment on something peaceful, light, a letting go, a melting, a relief. That has a lot to do, I think, with being able to let go of this reaching out toward the future of intentional knowledge. And the fact that we keep coming back into it, and that, as you were saying, Arthur, we may not, you may have the sense when you're doing a practice at any given time that you never really escape it, that you're always structuring your experience. That's just something to notice, something to be aware of.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I suppose it's a little bit like what I said about sad movies, you know, when you see this sad tendency of the self to involve itself, to take over, to continue to insist on its central role, even in something as simple as breathing, the very clarity of seeing that takes you to maybe a different level. You know, the clarity of knowledge in itself doesn't depend on the self, and in itself, you could say, escapes from the self. But that's something we're going to continue to look at here now as we go ahead. I think I'm going to do a wrap-up because it's time. Essentially, what we're going to do now is look with more care at the way that the self packages up experience in the form of a story, and then really tie that in more closely to time. Because one of the things that Rinpoche does in the time-space knowledge vision is he doesn't, and he's very clear about this, he doesn't attack the self and say, oh, you know, look at how the self just takes our experience and makes it into a possession, and so we never really experience anything. Yes, that's all part of the analysis. But he doesn't say, so what we've got to do is take this terrible self and kick it out the door, because it's very difficult for the self to do that. What he does instead, one of the many different approaches that he takes, is through time. And that's why we've been insisting so much, and why he insists so much, that the self and its structures that it insists on are so completely involved in the nature of the temporal order. So that's what we're going to continue to do. Kathleen, I just noticed that I didn't actually record this session, so I hope it was being automatically recorded. We can talk about that later, but I'm mentioning it now because I don't want you to erase it if you do have it. So we'll figure out how to deal with that. I think that the comments that people have been making in the chat room are very good. Kathleen says she did record it, so that's great. Good to know. Very good. We are ready to move ahead. And we'll meet again next week.